Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
On this episode of Most Notorious, a murderer stalks southwestern Montana in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
The lawyer is not only astounded, but so is the prosecutor when the defense lawyer comes to him and says, "How about if you take the death penalty off the table and we confess to two more killings?"
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious podcast. This episode involves the murder of a child, and listener discretion is advised. I am so pleased to have as my guest today, on his second visit to Most Notorious, Ron Francell. He is the acclaimed author of 18 books, including the international true crime bestsellers The Darkest Night, and the 2017 Edgar finalist, Morgue, A Life in Death. His debut book, Angel Fire, was listed by the San Francisco Chronicle as one of the 100 best novels of the 20th century West. Allison Gerald, A Homicidal Love Story, one of his more recent books, was the subject of our Most Notorious interview back in 2019. And he is here today to talk about his newest book, titled Shadow Man, An Elusive Psycho Killer and the Birth of FBI Profiling. Great to have you back on. Thank you for joining me once again.
Eric, thank you for having me. I'm privileged to have a little more time with you.
Yes, this is exciting. So when did you first come across this case, and what made you think it would be a great topic to write about?
Let me start by saying that the secret of my success as a writer has been that I never pick a story I can screw up. And I think Shadow Man early on struck me as one of those. I mean, its power was kind of universal. It was a mother's anguish and persistence among the law enforcement and our fear of the dark. So immediately it appealed to me. I first heard about it when I was a senior writer at the Denver Post, and my job was covering the American West, and I think sometime in Montana, I heard the basic story, which is basically about a kidnapping and then the resulting creation of the FBI's first criminal profile. That's about all I knew. So I kind of set it aside and really didn't revisit it for more than a decade. When I did, I discovered it was more than a simple kidnapping, a lot more. It was about this grotesque series of crimes in a part of the country where I grew up. I grew up in Wyoming, and this is in Montana, and they're otherwise indistinguishable except for maps. But it was also this turning point in forensic history, and nobody had ever told the stories, either one of them. So the more I dug, the more I wanted to know. And when it came down to it, I saw these two stories kind of on a collision course, these ghastly crimes and this historic moment. And it all centered around this one little girl.
So let's just start there, if that makes sense. Will you tell us about the Yeager family and their ill-fated vacation in June of 1973?
Yeah, exactly. They start west on this grand family vacation from Michigan. They stop at all the wonderful roadside attractions along the way. They end up in a small state park in Montana. They have a great time there for a day or two. And the night before they leave, they expected to leave, four of their five kids kind of jam themselves into a camp tent and snuggle down in their sleeping bags and close together to stay warm and go to sleep. The next morning, one of them awakes early and notices that there's a big hole in the back of the tent and that their little sister, Susie, was gone. At first, they think, you know, she's just pushed her way out with a ripped seam or something and is going to the bathroom or messing around outside. But very quickly, they realize she's not there. And as they begin to fear the worst, they call the sheriff, and the sheriff calls the FBI, which is kind of required by federal law in cases like this. Within hours, they've got 1,000 people literally beating the bushes for this little girl, and they can't find her. And they've got no evidence. They've got no witnesses. They've got no leads. So they have no suspects. And they're flat-footed, and they're not really sure where to turn next. And that's the way it stays for weeks and then months until another crime happens.
Right, yeah. I mean, a campground is a difficult place to look for suspects, people coming in and out all the time. How did law enforcement dragnet an area like that?
Well, they were as confused as you are right now about how could someone in the middle of the night make their way to a camp tent that was fairly centrally located in this park and surrounded by other campers. This is summer. How could somebody make their way into the middle of a campground, slice open the back of a tent, drag out a little girl who they presumed would be struggling, maybe even trying to scream, and get to a vehicle or something and get away and disappear. And that was where they were stumped. The only bit of evidence that they had was that the deputy who arrived on the scene first noticed a kind of footstep path through the dew in the grass toward a parking lot that was nearby. But otherwise, that was it. That's all they had. And of course, that disappeared with the sun coming up. So they were flummoxed. They had no idea, and a lot of it didn't make sense. But they remained frustrated for, as I say, for weeks and months. And it's only, you know, in February of 1974 when teenage waitress in the nearby town of Manhattan, Montana, goes missing. Now, they don't have any sense. They haven't even thought that these two things are related. So they search for this young waitress, and they find her car hidden in a barn at a remote abandoned ranch. And as they look closer, they find shards of bones scattered everywhere. They collect what they can. They send it off to the Smithsonian, which rules that indeed these bones were the remains of a teenage to early 20s female. But among them were bones that belonged to a little girl under 10 years old. And at that point, they believed that these were the remains of Susie Yeager. And they now had one criminal or one set of criminals instead of two separate crimes. And while that sounds like a break in the case, the fact remains, other than these bones, they had no real physical evidence. They still had no witnesses. They still had no legitimate leads. And of course, no suspects. So this continues to be a frustrating situation for the lead FBI agent, a guy named Pete Dunbar.
So your book opens with a description of Southwest Montana and this little town of Manhattan in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Normally a tranquil, idyllic area of the country, but there had been a couple of violent incidents, you write, that had caused grief in the community, one on a bridge and another involving a Boy Scout.
Yeah. In the late 60s, 67, a young boy, 13 years old, was with a friend, and they were diving off a bridge into the river below, which what kids did in that town every summer, when he suddenly cries out, "I've been shot," and then he falls into the river and drifts away. The friend runs to the nearest farmhouse, which is about a mile away, and by the time cops arrive, deputies arrive, there's no sign of this boy who was presumably shot from the top of the bridge. They do find him in a few weeks, and he indeed was shot in the chest. But it was determined that because murders don't happen in Manhattan, Montana. It's not that kind of town. It's this little, as you said, idyllic town. They presumed that he'd been hit by a stray bullet, you know, somebody hunting rabbits or target practicing something, and that he'd been hit by a stray bullet that the shooter didn't even know happened. And that's the way they closed the case. They just said this was an accidental death, and it was put away. About a year later, there's a Boy Scout gathering in that same park that we talked about earlier. And there were 300 scouts there, and they were all in pup tents that were arrayed throughout the park, 5-6 feet apart, plus all their scout masters and troop leaders. One night, actually one morning, one of the scouts just erupts in fear. His tent mate was bleeding and barely conscious. He mobilized the scout leaders, who found this kid had been looked like he had been beaten and stabbed. They didn't know. They called the sheriff, who rushed the kid in. to the hospital. And a few days later, he died, not of his stab wounds, but of his head injuries. It looked like somebody had bashed him with a blunt instrument or kicked him. The investigation into that kind of went off in the direction of the tent mate, a 12-year-old kid. There was a belief that maybe they'd been, roughhousing as little boys will do, and was being done by all the scouts in this tamperee. And that during that he had fallen and hit his head, and they kept it a secret so not to get in trouble, something like that. And again, that's kind of where they left it, that this was an accidental thing it didn't need to go farther. So those two crimes are sitting back there in 1967 and 68, both related to this little town. But they weren't considered murders. They were just tragic accidental deaths.
So after Susie Yeager disappears, authorities canvass the area, drumming up suspects that include members of biker gangs, drifters.
Right. Everything. I think there's, they were fanning out across the region. They were going to the local bordello and asking the girls if they had, done business with any especially weird people. And they were doing everything they could. They were doing what lawmen did and still do to a great degree. And that is a lot of footwork and talking to a lot of people and trying to logic this thing out about what might have happened. And they were still coming up empty. The Sandra Smalligan issue comes in suddenly they're thinking that there's somebody out there who has to be local. They couldn't have some drifter or some passerby doing these two crimes 8 months apart and disposing of the remains in the way he or she did. But that's about where it ended. And they had, occasionally names would pop up, but they tended to be from people who were kind of settling scores with other people, not seriously thought out accusations. It was, people reporting the guy who skipped out on his rent or something. So it can't be overstated that in those first 8 or 10 months, they had no ideas. They were flat flummoxed. They had nothing.
The Yeager family, of course, was beside themselves, in shock, in grief. They were all eager to help, especially Marietta, Susie's mom.
Yeah. I mean, they did what they could, but there wasn't much. They stayed on there in the campground for a long time. They were supported by the locals who'd bring food over or whatever they needed. But the time came that they had to go home to Michigan. And so they do that, and they sit by the phone and they hope that the news is going to break. They hope that their daughter is going to be found and returned to them. There was a part, a secret part of them that believed she was dead, and another part that didn't want to believe that. So they are patiently waiting for some information. The FBI is doing a good job of keeping them updated. The problem is that there's not much to tell them because nothing is happening. It's a couple of months after the waitress was found and Susie Yeager's remains, both presumptive. It was a couple months after that that the lead detective or the lead agent, Pete Dunbar, is in Quantico for some ordinary routine training in the FBI. And he happens to attend a workshop by these two fellow FBI agents, one who had a background in psychology and another one who was known to be a great crime scene analyst. And they had gotten together and had an idea that there was a way to look at a crime scene and the evidence and deduce certain things about the behavior and the psychology of the perpetrator. It hadn't really gotten traction because Hoover opposed it, but Hoover was gone. He had recently died, and more progressive leadership had come into the FBI, and they gave these two agents, Howard Teton and Pat Mullaney, a little longer leash. And they were able to pursue some research a little more openly, even though on the street, cops and deputies and other law enforcement still were suspicious of this voodoo. And Dunbar attends this workshop, and when it's over, he thinks, you know, I've got nothing. Maybe these guys could help me. And he literally follows them back to their basement offices and presents the story of Susie Yeager and of Sandy Smulligan, the waitress. They examine his case file later, and they assume that this might be a case that would be good to test their theory. And so they tell him that yes, they'll create the first ever profile. They considered it a safe one to test the theory. You know, they thought this is a couple of kidnappings that end in murder. So let's see if we can come up with anything. I hate to use the word ordinary, but it tended to be a more ordinary case on first examination. Of course, it grows into something far bigger and darker than they ever imagined. But at the beginning, they saw it as a no-risk or a low-risk case to test their theory.
We will return after these brief messages.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
We are back. So this first FBI profile, what were some of the characteristics they believed the killer they were hunting for possessed?
Well, we have, you know, between 15 and 20 elements in this first profile, and there are, some of it was experience and logic, some of it was guesswork, but you got to remember they had no rule book, they had no roadmap, they had no established system. They had their experiences, but they had no model. It was all based on what they knew and like I say, a little bit of guesswork. You know, these days, we all, anybody that's watched TV or movies or even read newspaper stories knows that the first presumption is that a serial killer tends to be a white male in his 20s. And that's because we have more than 50 years of data. And today's profilers have talked to thousands of killers. They know, and they know that that's a predominant description. Teton and Mullaney had visited with a couple of killers, and they had no database. In this case, they deduced that the killer was a white male in his 20s because the crimes themselves seem to require an astounding a degree of stealth and strength. That suggested whoever did it had military experience during Vietnam, which is going on at the time. That's largely male. They believed that this killer, this abductor, and what they presumed was a killer, had knowledge of surroundings, or he wouldn't have been able to get away as easily. He wouldn't have been able to take the risks that required to go into that crowded campground and abduct a little girl in the middle of the night, where maybe he can't see much in the dark either. He had to know local law enforcement, maybe he was lacking in training and didn't have much experience with this kind of thing. And that suggested that knowledge about moving around at night and the training and the abilities of local law enforcement suggested he was local in that county. It was almost completely white. So you put all those things together and you come up with white male in his 20s. And that's kind of how it went. Some of their other elements, they believed the unsub was probably fairly intelligent. The crimes showed somebody that was a highly organized thinker. And he had anticipated a lot of the investigation. They deduced he was a loner, and he probably wasn't married, and probably had very little experience with women, and that when he did, it didn't last. That's what they knew about people who they presumed him to be among, that they didn't see any evidence that suggested that other than how it happened. So this was their experience. They believed his heterosexual experience was limited. They believed he worked alone in a solitary profession, like a cowboy or a carpenter or something. And the reason is he doesn't want to interact with other people. You know, we all have different lives, and criminals are no different. And they just try to protect these secret lives that they have. So they would feel vulnerable among bosses and coworkers who they presumed could see these secrets and know them. And so they don't want to work with other people. It was things like that. And then it goes on to be a little more complicated as they go. It just proceeded from there. They believed he had killed before. Some of this showed evidence that he was not a first-timer, that he had actually had some learning involved. He had progressed. So you see where they're going. They're trying to tell the FBI agent and the local law enforcement the kind of person they'd be looking for. The military thing would allow them to narrow their pool a little bit. Did they know he had military experience? No, it was a guess. But it was a good guess. And so they were able to save a little energy, a little bit of time by looking at people with military experience. And that's the way a profile works. It's not always dead on. It's just saying your guy or your woman, they are part of this limited subgroup of people, or are likely members of that subgroup. So that gives investigators a place to start, and that's what they did here.
Right. So there were two separate murder investigations going on. As far as Sandy's case, the FBI believed that her boyfriend, Bob Harrison, might have had something to do with her death. But there was another character, a peripheral suspect named David Meyerhofer, also in the picture. Agent Dunbar, however, didn't really believe that he had anything to do with either Sandy or Susie's case. He thought David was odd and socially inept more than anything, and felt sorry for him.
Yeah, Dunbar at different times thinks they're wasting their time by going back with this, you know, and questioning this guy because he always comes off as decently intelligent, well-dressed, well-spoken, interested in the work that the investigators were doing, even offering to help if he could. He didn't have any record of anything, not speeding tickets, not anything. He was an entrepreneur. He bought houses and remodeled them and rented them. He had great carpentry skills. He just didn't seem like a killer. And he kept popping up for different reasons, but also being dismissed. I think he gets on the FBI's radar three or four times, and then falls off the FBI's radar, you know, as often. He had dated Sandy Smulligan, the waitress, once. And he had feelings for her, but she didn't much like him. She considered him to be odd, as most of the townsfolk did. They considered him just a little off. But small towns are populated by eccentrics, right? That's just normal. David sent chocolates and flowers, but she just wasn't interested. And he kept asking her and she kept rebuffing him. At the same time, she's going through a divorce. She has a boyfriend, Bob Harrison, but she has other guys that are courting her. And sometimes she goes out and sometimes she doesn't. She's not, you know, being lewd or loose with them. She's free. And the local guys know that. And she's pretty. So they're snuggling up as much as they can. So all of those guys become potential. Well, let's call them persons of interest. In some ways, the FBI has moved forward a little bit, but nobody is popping up as a really good suspect. In fact, that David Meyerhofer that we were talking about took two lie detector tests and passed both of them without even any hint that he might be lying about something. So they were left flat-footed, and the frustration continued. Moving to the next sort of important event, one of the elements of the profile that Teton and Mullaney delivered was that they believed the perpetrator in this case was that this was a very intimate crime to him, and that as such, it would take on intimate values to him. And the way we celebrate birthdays and wedding anniversaries, he would celebrate some kind of anniversary too. So they warned Dunbar to be especially vigilant on anniversaries important to the crimes. On the first year anniversary of Susie Yeager's disappearance, the phone rings at the family home in Michigan, and the caller identifies himself as the abductor of the little girl, claims that he still has her and he's brainwashing her to think he's her father. They're not sure about whether this is a hoax or not until he delivers a description of the little girl, of a small defect in the little girl's hand that they had never discussed publicly. In fact, her mother had never even mentioned it to the FBI. When he mentions it, then they know that they have the little girl's abductor and, again, who they presumed had killed her. Now this moves forward a little bit, even though they don't know who that is. They don't know where the call is coming from. They know very little, but they are moving forward a little bit. And while they're frustrated still, they feel like they've made some headway. So that's up to 1 year later, and this phone call comes.
In the call, the way he treats Marietta on the call, it's sadistic, right? He taunts her, gives her the false hope that her daughter is still alive. He said that she was traveling around with him. He was taking her to places like Disneyland. But by the end of the call, he's sobbing. And it was an odd trajectory for a phone conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a clue to the profilers as well. He did just what you said. He taunted her. He was saying sadistic things. It was horrifying, and And if you try to see the things that he was saying through the eyes of a grieving mother, you can sense that it was more horrific than even what we're talking about right now. But she hangs in there. She stays on the line with him and she talks to him. She's amazingly stalwart in it, even though inside she's afraid and she's sickened and he's getting to her. But she hangs in there. She stays on the line with him. She challenges him. She talks. She questions. By the end of the call, as you point out, he is kind of losing his composure, not getting angry, but getting sad. In fact, kind of crying at the end. And the reason, say this, the profilers later, is because he wanted control of her, and that was the reason for his sadism and his taunting. But when she stood up to it, he lost control. He couldn't control her. And so he was unable, or at least handicapped, when dealing with strong women. And they suddenly knew that about him, or believed they did. And that again moves it a little forward. And they were able to say, okay, well, you're looking at somebody who, you know, in his relationships with people likes to be in control, and is put off when he doesn't have it. So they said, you need to look at somebody with a particular relationship to his mother, because they believe that's where it came from.
Right.
Is that true? I don't know. We don't know, actually, to this day, whether that was true. Events in the investigation keep us from knowing. But these were deductions they were making along the way, based on what they were learning.
Back again after a quick break.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
We have returned once more. So, Dunbar still believes that Meyerhofer really doesn't have anything to do with this, but agents Mullaney and Teton are more than ever convinced that Meyerhofer needs to be looked at. So Dunbar contacts the U.S. Marine Corps, and Dunbar is also able to access Meyerhofer's old therapy records and uncovers some really uncomfortable details about Meyerhofer's earlier years.
Yeah, he does a deep dive on David Meyerhofer, and in some ways you turn up some ordinary things like being in the military, in the Marine Corps, and some things extraordinary like those psychological examinations of him. He is warming to the idea that Meyerhofer is a good suspect, but he's still not convinced. And there's some conflict between him and the profilers. The profilers are becoming more and more convinced that Meyerhofer is a good suspect. Dunbar, not as quickly. But he does his due diligence. And like I say, he does a deep dive on Meyerhofer, and he finds some things that are intriguing, particularly in Dunbar's or in Meyerhofer's psychological profile. So we're now moving more deliberately toward some suspects and some people of interest. As they get more interested in Meyerhofer, another call comes to the Jaeger residence in Michigan. And this time it's a little more pointed, and the caller says that he has a little girl, her little girl, with him. And he holds the phone up, and there's a child's voice in the background. It doesn't sound like Susie to Marietta, but there's some concern that even if it isn't her, he has another child. So now there's an urgency about this. At this point, they're really interested in Meyerhofer, and he's under surveillance. They learn that that phone call came from Salt Lake City, a motel in Salt Lake City. But Meyerhofer hasn't been out of their sight in Manhattan, Montana during that period. So how could it be him? Once again, the interest in him shudders a little bit. They're just not sure they have the right guy. So the investigation continues, and we can talk about that, but I have a feeling you have more questions.
Well, yeah. So not long before that second call, Dunbar decided that what might be a helpful idea was to have Marietta meet with Meyerhofer. So he arranges a sit-down. Actually, they talk a couple of times. Would you share with us the gist of these interactions between them?
Yeah, it goes back to that belief in the profile, among the profilers, that he didn't react well with strong women. And they had the idea that if they could put them face to face and she could just do what she had done in previous phone calls, that maybe they'd shake him up a little bit. They did that. They took her out to Montana. They put them in the same room, and she repeatedly accused him of being the killer and would say, "I know you took my daughter. I know it's you. Please tell me. Tell us what you did. Tell us that you did it." And he stood his ground, and he was even sympathetic. He said, "Ma'am, I know what this must feel like, but I'm not your guy." It was an interesting thing. Marietta comes away more convinced that it's him. Call it mother's intuition. But there's no proof. There's no smoking gun here. They also arranged, by the way, that face-to-face meeting unknown to him. They wanted it to be a surprise. And they felt that was going to betray certain things about him if he had to confront it, you know, without thinking about it. So it didn't. But that's the way they were thinking. So that's an important moment in the sense that he did talk to her, but that he knew that she knew. And a later phone call between him, purporting to be somebody else, she calls him David, and he reacts by saying, who are you talking about? Who is David? Who would that? I'm not David. And she persisted and said, I know you're David. And he was shaken up by that. So there are all these interesting interactions between Marietta Yeager and David Meyerhofer that really lead to the outcome that the book describes.
Right. And so the FBI comes up with a plan. They wanted Marietta to identify Meyerhofer's voice as the one she spoke with on the telephone call. So they create a telephone lineup, and they have five people call her, including Meyerhofer, to see if she can pick his voice out.
Yeah. Well, they had recorded the one call where he purported to have a little girl. And they took that recording and excerpted some things. They then had five men, including Meyerhofer, and including a cousin of his who kind of sounded like him. And then they took that script and had them recite it. They presented that, you know, they played those recordings for Marietta and for her husband separately in a different room. They both very quickly and very confidently identified David's voice. Voice printing at that point was not considered a trustworthy forensic science, but it gave them some sense of whether they were on the right track. Had they needed to go to court with that, it might have been questioned and might have not even been allowed, but it gave them some idea of whether they were on the right path or not, and they believed they were.
So when did things really start getting hot for Meyerhofer?
It was a casual, voluntary search of his place that turned up some things that were incriminating, not smoking guns, but were incriminating. So at that point, they were not ready to slap the cuffs on him, so to speak. But they were pretty confident he was their guy. It's after that Salt Lake City phone call and the possibility that he had another child that they believed they had to act. They couldn't let him continue to walk. There were some questions about whether he could make that trip. They later learned that he actually had escaped in the dark from his apartment and gotten away from the surveillance. That's when they swung into action. It leads a couple of days to his arrest. And in the search of his home subsequent to that arrest, they find the smoking gun. They find human remains in his freezer that turn out quickly to are proven to be Sandy Smalligan's remains. So at that point, they have him. There's no question. His lawyer, who has believed in him all along, has believed that he's just being harassed by the cops, is shown this evidence. And the first thing he does is he goes back onto the front lawn and he vomits. Then he confronts David himself and very angrily says, "You are going to hang. There's no question, because this human remains in your freezer, the jury is going to have a tough time looking past that."
Yeah.
David then proposes, would they take the death penalty off the table if I could confess to two more murders? The lawyer is not only astounded, but so is the prosecutor when the defense lawyer comes to him and says, "How about if you take the death penalty off the table and we confess to two more killings?" Ultimately, they agree to do that. David is taken into an overnight interview, starts at about 2 a.m. And their goal is to get him to describe these four deaths: Susie, Sandy Smalligan, and it turns out the two little boys in 67 and 68. So they have now a guy confessing to four murders. And tomorrow, they figure they'll come back and ask more questions about other cases, about his background and that sort of thing. But overnight, they lose their chance. So I don't know if I want to spoil it for people, but that's one reason today, 50 years later, we still have a lot of questions about the motivations, the psychology, the behavior here. And that's part of the story in this book, about regardless of the profiling that goes on and what we know about psychology of criminals, we still have questions about this case.
Yeah, the discovery of Sandy's remains in his freezer, specifically her hand with red painted nails, was absolutely gruesome. His confession, unfortunately, they didn't get a chance to talk to him for long. What did he tell them that he had done with Susie?
Well, he admitted that he had abducted her. He had taken her to this abandoned ranch out in the middle of nowhere. He had molested her. And when she reacted, crying and screaming, he killed her. He strangled her. He then butchered her. I'm sorry if your listeners are sensitive to that. I apologize. But he butchered her. Then he cremated her and pulverized her bones and spread them out over this ranch, just the way he did later with Sandy Smalligan, whose murder he also confessed to that night. So there's some unsettling parts of that. In the book, I put the actual conversation that happened. I have that among 13,000 FBI documents. I have the actual transcript of that interview. So that's in the book. It's not my interpretation of what they say, my dramatization of what they say. It's what they said. And I think readers are going to find that fascinating.
What was his motive, do you think, for killing Sandy?
Good question. We don't know. The way he described her killing was that he intended to abduct her. He he went to her apartment, which was actually within sight of his, that he went in and he, you know, tied her hands together and put tape over her mouth and put her in her car to take her out someplace to do God knows what, maybe to kill her, maybe to rape her, maybe just to talk to her. Along the way, though, she suffocates from that tape over her mouth and nose. So she's dead by the time he gets out to that ranch. And then he repeats that awfulness of cremation, butchery and cremation and pulverization of the bones and the scattering of those remains. So there's Susie Yeager and Sandy Smulligan, their pulverized bones all spread across this ranch area. And that's what ultimately, when they find it, leads to the profile, which then leads to him. So it's kind of a complicated way for me to explain it, but I think it makes sense in the book.
What about his motive for killing the Boy Scout, Michael Rainey? Do you have any idea?
I've asked this question about what was the serial part of his killings? What was the thing that tied them all together? We have two young teenage boys. We have a 7-year-old girl and we have a 19-year-old woman. There's nothing similar about them. He uses a gun in one case. He uses a knife in another. God knows what he used. Sandy Smulligan just dies and suffocates. And he strangles little Susie. So not even the weaponry and the method of dying is killing is the same. So what's it serial? Because that's what we've been trained to think about, the kind of victims, the weapons, what motivated him. Nobody knows. They never got a chance to go that deep with him. I personally think we see in his psychological profile some conversations that he had with the psychiatrist about his sexuality. He seemed to a lot of people, including the psychiatrist, to be a gay man who couldn't deal with being gay, and that it was something that he didn't want to confront, and that was the underlying motive. I talked to a forensic psychologist about this who said the kind of victim, the kind of weapons, the way they died aren't where the serial part of this was. The serial part of this was his rage. He killed all of these people in a rage. Where that rage came from is the question, and it's an unanswered question at this point.
So Marietta is a very strong woman. She did an amazing job of keeping her composure through all of this outwardly, despite the intense grief she obviously experienced. After the funeral of Susie in Montana, Marietta goes into the junk shop run by Meyerhofer's mother, and they actually have a brief exchange.
They do, and it's two mothers both grieving for different reasons. She forgives David's mother. David's mother had nothing to do with it, but she wanted to allay the embarrassment, and she does a good job of that. She really does honestly and genuinely feel like this is two mothers talking about a terrible event in both of their lives. There's no question that without Marietta, you and I are talking today about a cold case that happened in Montana, that we don't know who did it. And that's the fact. Without her, this crime doesn't get solved. And she's a hero. She's the hero of this story. So what we have is this very basic human anguish over on that side of it, and the pain that we know she felt. And then over on this other end, we have this scientific pursuit to create something that will help them find more bad guys and maybe prevent some of that grief that we saw. But we have the human element and the scientific element, the heart and the head. And I think that's one of the beauties of this particular story, is that, you know, we get to talk about a real conflict between the heart and the head. And it attracted me. Again, I go back to, I don't pick stories that I can screw up, and I couldn't screw this one up. It's a beautiful story about that, about a grieving mother and these two pioneering guys trying to come up with something to help the rest of us.
Right, right. Why do you call him Shadow Man?
Because, you know, he functions in the shadows. Susie Yeager's abduction happens in the middle of the night. And for some reason, he's able to navigate this park and all the other campers that are there and go in, get her, and get out without being noticed. Same thing in the Boy Scouts killing. Same thing in the shooting of the boy on the bridge. Same thing in the abduction of Sandy Smulligan, and that then he can function almost completely in the shadows and is comfortable in the shadows. Even his personality exists in light and dark. So to me, he was of the shadows, and that's what led to the title.
Yeah, it's a great title. So your book is officially out in bookstores and online.
Yes, indeed. Anywhere you buy books.
Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on.
Once again, thank you for making time for me.
Again, I have been speaking to Ron Francell, author of Shadow Man, an elusive psycho killer, and the birth of FBI profiling. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.